Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. With the Supreme Court confirmation hearings opening on March 21st, this week we'll learn more about the court's history. If President Biden's nominee, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, gets confirmed by the Senate, she will become the first African-American woman to hold that honor and only the sixth woman overall. Renee Kanaki Jefferson, a professor at the University of Houston Law Center and co-author of Shortlisted, discusses the nomination of Judge Jackson and some of the women who have been considered for the high court in the past, but were ultimately passed over.
I'm pleased to nominate Judge Jackson, who will bring extraordinary qualifications, deep experience and intellect, and a rigorous judicial record to the court.
As it happens, I share a birthday with the first Black woman ever to be appointed as a federal judge, the Honorable Constance Baker Motley. We were born exactly 49 years to the day apart. Today, I proudly stand on Judge Motley's shoulders, sharing not only her birthday, but also her steadfast and courageous commitment to equal justice under law. Judge Motley's life and career has been a true inspiration to me as I have pursued this professional path.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson, your book, Shortlisted, tells the history of women's consideration for the high court in the United States. So what are your thoughts on the significance of President Biden's announcement?
It's a long time coming. We have had Black women on president's shortlists ever since women were allowed to join the Supreme Court. So go back to 1981 when Ronald Reagan gave us the first female Supreme Court justice with Sandra Day O'Connor. But I learned in my research that women were shortlisted decades even before that. And so it's an exciting moment for the country. It's long overdue.
Additionally, if confirmed, Judge Jackson will bring the total of female justices to four, which is as close to parity as you can get on a court of nine. What's the significance of this?
It's the first time ever the nation will see four women justices presiding over cases at the Supreme Court at the same time. And I think it's important because we will no longer have one woman or maybe a few. But for a long time, I mean, Sandra Day O'Connor was the only woman on the court, and she was expected to represent all things to all people about the woman's perspective. In fact, she said when she was nominated and then confirmed that she was very honored and excited to be the first, but she didn't want to be the last. And so just enormous pressure also in that role. And what we are about to see is that women have all sorts of different perspectives and experiences and views, and it matters for how cases are decided at the Supreme Court, but it also matters because it's such a publicly high-profile role that the public will begin to appreciate that women in professional life can also have this wide range of diversity, and not just in terms of race and gender, but also in terms of their life experiences, their views on issues, and beyond.
How does the United States compare with other Western democracies in this topic?
Well, we lag behind. And I will say, though, at least that's with respect to the Supreme Court. Our state courts do much better. So on the U.S. Supreme Court, it's very exciting. We will now have four women sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. Still not a majority of women on the court, which would, of course, more accurately reflect the public that the court serves. But it's one step closer. We've never had a female Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Our state courts do much better. In fact, there have been numerous female chief justices of state Supreme Courts. But the U.S. Supreme Court has long lagged behind, and this will bring it one step closer to, again, better reflecting the public that it serves.
Well, maybe you could build on that a little bit, because the public polling is often mixed on this. Sometimes the majority say that it shouldn't matter, and the Chief Justice famously in his confirmation hearings referred to the job of the justice as being calling balls and strikes. So really, why does gender or racial diversity make a difference in the high court?
Well, there's a few reasons. I mean, to be sure, with this appointment, it's not going to change the six three conservative majority, that ideological divide that is present on the court. But the diversity matters well beyond just that particular makeup at this moment in time. It matters, one, for institutional legitimacy. The Supreme Court has its power and its authority because the public believes in it. And the public is more likely to view it as a credible institution, as a legitimate institution, if it more accurately reflects the public it serves. It also matters because this will inspire young girls, young Black girls, especially with the nomination now of Judge Jackson, hopefully soon to be Justice Jackson, across the country to become lawyers, become judges, but importantly, aspire to and know that they can attain the highest pinnacle of their professional choice, whether it's the United States Supreme Court or a different profession. And then it also matters because it makes a difference in terms of how cases are decided. And we know this because the justices talk about it. In fact, the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg commented frequently that she would bring the perspective of a woman into the discussions that the justices would have about the cases. One of the most notable cases involved the strip search of a young teenage girl. And she talked publicly about the fact that she was able to help the justices understand, the male justices understand, why that would be a particularly sensitive time for a woman. And so it matters for all of these reasons. There are multiple layers to the significance of this, and it is important for the court to have justices that more accurately reflect the public it serves. Not that any particular justice is going to decide a case a certain way, but white men have represented every perspective, religion, political divide for most of this nation's history on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's time for women to have the opportunity to represent that diversity as well.
During her confirmation hearings, Sonia Sotomayor's diversity, bringing the first Latina to the court, was an issue for some of the senators. This was an exchange that you wrote about in your book, Shortlisted. Let's listen.
Have you ever seen a case where, to use your example, the wise Latina made a better decision than the non-Latina judges?
I was using a rhetorical riff that harkened back to Justice O'Connor. Justice O'Connor was a part of a court in which she greatly respected her colleagues. And yet, those wise men, I'm not going to use the other word, and wise women did reach different conclusions in deciding cases. The words I chose, taking the rhetorical flourish, is a bad idea.
In hindsight, how did you process that exchange and what the significance of it was?
Well, it surprised me that she was asked about it at all. Well, I guess I shouldn't say it didn't surprise me, because I have conducted an extensive media study where I looked at the coverage of, and I'm not blaming the nominees here, really, it's the coverage is reflecting the public acceptance of male and female nominees to the Supreme Court from the 1970s through the nominations of Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. And in fact, women experience more scrutiny based on their gender than men. And so I guess on the one hand, I'm surprised that kind of question, I don't know that it should have necessarily come up in that context, or at least it shouldn't have been received in the way it was in terms of being perceived as a negative against her. And in fact, Justice Alito talked about in his Senate confirmation hearings that his experience, his Italian heritage, informed the way he viewed immigration cases, for example. And he said that he thought about his ancestors and his background and his heritage when he decided cases. And so that's an example where what is viewed as perhaps a neutral comment for a male nominee to be making, or maybe it's even considered a plus on his side, a very similar kind of comment made by now Justice Sotomayor was subject to attack and scrutiny in a negative light.
A couple more questions on court diversity. legal diversity. If confirmed, Judge Jackson will bring her record as a public defender and also serving on the U.S. Sentencing Commission, unlike any of the other justices. What does this perspective bring to the court?
I'm glad you asked this question because she brings far more diversity than just her race and gender to this appointment. This background is important. Her work as a public defender matters because, of course, public defenders are the lawyers who represent individuals facing criminal charges who can't afford a lawyer of their own. And it's a very different perspective than anyone else on the court currently has. The last justice with a background as a public defender would have been Thurgood Marshall. And so her work in that role and then also on the Sentencing Commission is going to give her keen insight into the criminal justice process. And she also has had a family member who has gone through it, who's been incarcerated. And so she has that life experience as well. And I think that that will be an important perspective that she can bring to bear as the court faces criminal justice issues.
You often hear discussion, and sometimes by committee members, about the legal training of the people that are nominated to the court coming for the last couple of decades from Ivy League law schools. You teach at the University of Houston Law Center, and I'm wondering what your thought is on that sort of diversity and the necessity of bringing people from other institutions than the Ivies to the court.
Well, I think it's an important factor, and it was notable to me, of course, that Justice Barrett was not from that same cohort. And it's not just something that I noticed. I mean, presidents in previous administrations would look at all sorts of different measures of diversity, even if they weren't focusing on gender at the time. They would look at geography, if a justice was from out west or if they were from the Midwest or East Coast. And we don't have much diversity in terms of geography either on the current Supreme Court, although the justices, to be sure, grew up under different types of circumstances in their childhoods. Most of them grew up inside or very nearby major metropolitan areas, New York, D.C., and of course, your point is well taken in terms of educational diversity, but that's why there was some boosting of another potential nominee on Biden's shortlist, J. Michelle Childs, because she has her education from public schooling, both for her law degree and her undergraduate degree. And I think that diversity is important. There's nothing that says that a Supreme Court justice has to graduate from an Ivy League school. And I certainly hope that if President Biden is able to bring more women from his shortlist or future administrations, that they are thinking about diversity beyond just race and gender for the court, but also geography and educational background, and importantly, the law practice experience that a justice has had before they come to the court.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Judge Michelle Childs and also the other name that was floated publicly, California State Justice Leandra Kruger. I'm wondering, first of all, if you were to write a book in the future, would they be on your short list by definition? We don't know if President Biden was ever considering them. We know that the press and public members of Congress were floating their names.
That's a great question. How do you know who is on the short list? So for our purposes, we determined it was a president's official short list. If I could find the actual list written up in president's archives. So I spent many years digging through the papers of Presidents Reagan, Ford, and beyond, or if it was reported in the media as the president's official shortlist. That was in the case of Nixon. His list was leaked to the media, and he had a list of six when he ultimately nominated Justices Rehnquist and Powell. And of course, for President Biden and President Obama, too, I'm not able to get into their papers now. They haven't been made publicly available. And so in terms of if I were to write who was on the shortlist going forward, I think that we would say the names that have rose to the top so repeatedly, and the three that we're talking about right now, must have been on that Biden shortlist. And of course, I will leave it to a future scholar who will have the ability to go through his archives to find out whether or not there was an actual list created. But some administrations, there was not, at least that we could find, a physical piece of paper. In others, there were.
Would your research indicate what careers will be like for these two judges after being so publicly floated and then not getting the nod?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, for some women who have been nominated or publicly floated, that increased scrutiny is especially harsh. I mean, I think, and we write about in the book in particular, one woman who made it off the shortlist but not onto the court, and that was Harriet Myers. And the public scrutiny was extremely damaging for her. Although I think her career went on to be fine, the public commentary and coverage, much of it quite unfounded. We discovered in our research that if you looked at her credentials, they were actually quite similar to that of Justice Powell, for example. They both had been presidents of the Bar Association and that sort of thing. But she had grueling and highly gendered, highly inappropriate media coverage of her. We saw less of that here. And I think that that reflects something that is a lesson that we learned and we include in our paperback edition of Shortlisted, which came out just this year. So after the original book came out in 2020, in talking about it, we had the opportunity to get advice from individuals who have gone through this process more and more. And one piece that came up again and again is, if you're going to be vetted in this kind of public way to be on the shortlist, you want assurances that even if you aren't chosen, you will come away at least no worse off than before, and maybe even better, maybe with more opportunities. And of course, time will tell, but from the outside looking in, I believe that Biden, in vetting these potential nominees, treated them with respect and, you know, held them out in a way that hopefully they will be no worse off for being named as part of his ultimate shortlist, and perhaps even better off.
You referenced the extensive research that you and your co-author Hannah Brenner Johnson did on this topic. How did you both get started on this?
Well, that's a great question. So we were observing all of the very gendered media coverage that I've alluded to with the nominations of Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. So the comment about Justice Sotomayor being a wise Latina, that being taken out of context and used against her, that was sort of the least of it. I mean, the kinds of headlines we were seeing, it was focusing on the fact that they were both single, they didn't have children. Who would accompany them to fancy Supreme Court dinners? Would they have dates? The nation would have its first bachelorette. Commentary about their clothing, questioning their sexuality. And, you know, as academics, we have a lot of privilege and the ability to study and examine things. And so instead of just rolling our eyes at this coverage, we decided to study it. And we conducted an empirical investigation looking at every article the New York Times and the Washington Post had written about a Supreme Court nominee from the 1970s through the confirmations of Sotomayor and Kagan. And that is something that could be the topic of a whole other conversation between us. But I will tell you, in that research, we found one article that led to the creation of this book and our study of shortlists, to answer your question. And the article we found was written in 1971. It appeared in the New York Times when President Nixon was filling not one, but two vacancies on the Supreme Court. And the article listed six names. Two of them were women: Sylvia Bacon, who was a judge in Washington, D.C., and Mildred Lilly, a judge in California. And the article described their professional qualifications and also described Judge Lilly as having maintained her bathing beauty figure even in her 50s and fortunately having no children. So, of course, that fit into our thesis of our media study that women receive this more gendered coverage. But that's actually not why it was so interesting to me. I wondered, who's Mildred Lilly? And who's Sylvia Bacon? Why have I never heard of these women's names in a high school history class, even in a law school feminism class? I had no idea who they were. And I also had no idea that presidents had been considering women before Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman to join the court. So not to take away from Sandra Day O'Connor at all, but as it turns out, we set out to research it. And in addition to judges Lilly and Bacon, There were seven others, a total of nine. We didn't mean to find enough to seat the whole Supreme Court, but as it turns out, there were nine women shortlisted by presidents before O'Connor became our first justice.
You talked about how difficult it was to find this because there's no requirement for presidents to be transparent about people that they're considering. So how did you actually discover some of these, especially the older presidents? How did you dig and find what you were looking for?
So it's a real shift because now presidents are quite transparent, and President Trump was perhaps the most transparent. You could go to whitehouse.gov and see his ever-growing shortlist during his term in office. But it really wasn't until, I would say, Nixon and then Reagan that the shortlist was used in this more political way. And just to, you know, say a little bit more about Nixon, he had two women on his shortlist, but he had no intention of appointing either one of them to the Supreme Court. I've listened to his Oval Office tape. So to your question about, you know, how did we find out this information, it meant literally going into presidential archives and digging through files of letters, telegrams, lots of telegrams, memos and that sort of thing, listening to tapes, reading memoirs, but listening to Nixon's Oval Office tapes, you know, behind the scenes, he would say things like he didn't think women should be allowed to vote, but he wanted their votes. And so that's why he was willing to put two women on his shortlist. And afterwards, he ultimately selected Justices Rehnquist and Powell. And he said publicly to women, well, but, you know, at least we considered women this time. So this was something that we discovered in this research that we, again, hadn't expected to, but really uncovering how sometimes shortlists are used appropriately, right? I mean, to be selected, you got to be on the shortlist. But sometimes they can be used to create the appearance of a commitment to diversity while preserving the status quo. And that, of course, is exactly what Nixon was doing with his.
We dug into the Nixon tapes as well, and I've got one for you and our audience to listen to with President Nixon talking to Attorney General John Mitchell on Mildred Lilly, two different calls from October of 1971. Let's listen.
So so far it's on track,
I'm telling you. You know, John, it just must really make you feel happy that you will be the Attorney General to have made the first recommendation woman on the court. That'll just make you feel great, doesn't it? How proud you can be back in your old colleagues in New York and the rest, huh?
Yes, sir. When I get with that new woman's lib, why, I'll be their hero. If I ever
tell you. Okay, boy.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Right, sir.
All of us laughing in the background here.
So far, it just looks great, and she's been reversed enough by the Supreme Court in California in criminal cases to give her a good standing with the law and order people.
Good, good, good.
She's got a good personality, I think.
Good,
people
good,
will,
good.
People will see that she's not one of these frigid bitches, you know.
That's right, I know, the terrible ones.
Yeah.
Renee Jefferson, what do you think? What do we learn about Richard Nixon and his intentions from those two calls?
Yeah, well, so I listened to those as well in my research, and I was being generous when I was only describing him as thinking women shouldn't vote. So, you know, I think that just completely exemplifies one of the concerns that we unpack in our shortlisted book, which is when on the surface an organization or an individual appears to be committed to diversity, but in fact, they use the public-facing shortlist to preserve the status quo by not ultimately selecting the diverse individual from it. And the challenge and what we have done in our research is to look at the ways these women who, even though they were shortlisted for the Supreme Court and never made it onto the court, in order to get to the point where they were even being considered by presidents, I mean, it's sort of, you know, horrible to say this, but for Mildred Lilly to be considered by Richard Nixon this way, she was incredibly accomplished. And we draw in the book lessons from these women's lives in terms of how they navigated such, you know, explicit prejudice against them in order to still succeed, and use that as strategies for addressing the continued bias that exists today, sometimes not as obvious or apparent as what the early women faced, but yet still needing to be addressed and resolved.
In the wake of Judge Jackson's nomination, you're telling of the story of Federal Judge Amelia Kearse made several news reports, a few articles around the country. She's still with us. She's age 84, senior judge with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. What's her story?
So, again, we had no idea what we would find when we set out to uncover how many women, if any, had been shortlisted before O'Connor. As it turns out, as I said, there are nine. And of those nine, there is only one minority woman, Amelia Kearse, the first Black female to be appointed to a federal court of appeals, the Second Circuit. And we feel like that is reflective of the additional burdens and barriers that minority women, especially Black women in this country, face. She was not only shortlisted by President Reagan for the seat that went to O'Connor, but he shortlisted her again. You know, Reagan could have given us more than one woman on the court. He had multiple vacancies. She was shortlisted for the seat that ultimately went to Justice Kennedy. And she was shortlisted again, or at least her name was floated when the nomination for Clarence Thomas was at risk of not going forward. And so she was suggested as a possible solution to President George H.W. Bush at that time. And then she was shortlisted again by President Clinton for the very seat that Justice Breyer is now retiring from. So finally, decades later, it will go to a Black woman. But she was an incredibly successful Black female attorney at a time when women were regularly told that they couldn't have a job because there weren't facilities for women in the law firm, like meaning like there weren't bathrooms or like an appropriate place for women to be in professional life. She was the first female partner at Hughes Hubbard and Reed, a prominent New York law firm. And she was a part of President Carter's innovation, if you will, when he came into office. You know, every president handles how they select judges differently, both for the Supreme Court and the lower courts. And when Carter came into office, he issued an executive order creating a series of commissions or panels across the country. And they were each charged with vetting potential judicial nominees in geographic regions. So the panels themselves were diverse in makeup. They importantly were tasked with diversifying who they were interviewing for judgeships. And even more importantly, one of the qualifications they were looking for from their applicants to be judges was a demonstrated commitment to diversity. Amelia Kearse, she sat on one of those panels and then ultimately was selected by one for her seat on the Second Circuit.
I'm curious about what the consideration of Amelia Kearse by both Democratic and Republican presidents says about the nomination process today and how it's evolved.
Well, it is certainly more partisan today, to be sure. Although it wasn't that long ago that we saw this similar sort of elevation of judges into justices by presidents from both parties. So Justice Sotomayor was originally a Bush appointee on a lower federal court. And then, of course, President Obama put her on the U.S. Supreme Court. So in some ways, it's not that long ago that the selection of justices was not so very partisan. But I think what it says more than anything is that this is a woman who was extraordinarily well qualified and absolutely should have been on the Supreme Court. We should have had a second woman join O'Connor in the 1980s. She was clearly qualified for it and ready. And that really defies this narrative that suggests somehow the nomination for Judge Jackson is affirmative action or the like, or the idea that there hasn't been a qualified pool of women or Black women to sit on courts. In fact, there has. It's just been overcoming sometimes explicit and often implicit prejudices and biases that have held them back.
In our opening clip, we heard Judge Jackson give credit to a federal judge who had inspired her, Constance Baker Motley. She passed away in 2005, African-American judge. Did she ever make a short list? And what can you tell us more about her?
So she absolutely had her name floated by various groups as being someone who would be deserving for a Supreme Court nomination, but she did not appear on any president's official shortlist that we found in our research. And I think there are a couple of pieces to that. So it's interesting to me, you know, her career trajectory was very similar to that of Thurgood Marshall. And Thurgood Marshall, of course, went from his extraordinary civil rights work to launching him to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and then onto the U.S. Supreme Court. And that should have been a path that would have placed Judge Motley also in that same trajectory. In fact, many thought that she would be appointed to the Second Circuit and then on to the Supreme Court. But that was not in the cards in terms of anything that a particular president was determined to do at any moment when they actually faced a vacancy. And I think part of that has to do with her race and also being a female, that she had the same credentials as Thurgood Marshall and yet was viewed as being too liberal or, you know, too much of a civil rights advocate, even though that was not at all how she was reflected in her decision making as a judge. And I will just, I can say it as a sort of a counterpoint to that. It's interesting to compare, of course, because Judge Kearse goes on to get that seat on the Second Circuit that some would have said belonged to Motley. And when she was appointed, we saw, so one of the interesting things about going through all of these presidential archives is not just seeing like what the presidents and their advisors are doing, but also reading of the onslaught of mail and telegrams that the president is receiving. And there was some pushback from civil rights groups, affinity groups, that Judge Kearse might not be sufficiently representative in that way. And so I have to think that, you know, there's some balancing and calculation that's going on behind the scenes, to be sure. But a lot of that has nothing to do with the actual qualifications of these women, because they were exceedingly qualified and they were ready and they were prepared, and they were held back for reasons that had nothing to do with their qualifications.
President Biden was criticized in some quarters for explicitly promising to name a black woman to the court. Supporters of this notion pointed back to Ronald Reagan, where he explicitly promised to appoint a woman. What are the historical parallels that you found in your research?
So it's absolutely right that Biden is not the first president to limit his selection of a qualified candidate to a particular demographic. And Ronald Reagan is perhaps the most famous because, of course, he campaigned on the promise to give us the nation's first female Supreme Court justice, and he delivered. He campaigned on that promise because his record on women was terrible. He had not appointed very many women judges as a governor in California. He did not support the Equal Rights Amendment, and he was running against a president who, you know, Carter, by the way, we talked about his selection process that led to putting Judge Kearse on the Second Circuit. Carter put more women on federal courts as judges than all presidents combined before him. And so Reagan is perhaps the, you know, most famous and most noted for narrowing his search in a similar way. But other presidents have looked at demographics when they are selecting a particular justice, whether, again, it's looking at geography or it's looking at religion. And that is not unusual, even if it's not necessarily as publicly known as it was in the case of Biden.
Your book suggests that Judge O'Connor, when nominated, was scrutinized more heavily because of her lack of federal experience. She came from the Arizona state courts. Would you explain where the criticism came from that and what were the concerns about her qualifications in that regard?
Well, I don't know if the concerns were well-founded, but the concerns were that she did not have the same kind of, you know, federal court experience or the number of years as a judge as her male counterparts that she would be joining. But I actually see it as a plus side that she brought the diversity of being both not just a judge on a state court, but she also was elected to the Arizona legislature. So she had that perspective as well. And of course, brought some geographic diversity at the time too. When she was selected, it came down to two. So on Reagan's shortlist, he had a number of names, men and women, but there were five women on his shortlist when he selected O'Connor. And it ultimately came down to two women. The other woman was Cornelia Kennedy. She was a judge on the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals at the time. And the consideration of the two of them, the interview process, those details are really interesting. In the case of O'Connor, the president's advisors flew out to Arizona to meet with her. She prepared them a meal and you know, hosted them. It was right after she just had the surgery, by the way. So, I can't imagine that was easy for her to do. But she would have been a very traditional female role in their vetting process, right? Judge Kennedy flew to Washington, D.C. for her final interview. She reflected on a conversation she had with her husband, you know, whether or not he should accompany her, or would it look like she's, you know, someone who can't make a decision without her husband along. She went on her own. I don't know that that was the final deal breaker, that contrast, but it's interesting to think about the juxtaposition and then the later questioning and speculation in contrast to Justices O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, who were both mothers in traditional marriages. And then part of the resistance, I think, that we saw in the nominations of Kagan and Sotomayor and the questioning that I alluded to earlier about their single status, that they didn't have children and the like, was simply because the stereotype of what a female justice should be had been limited to a very specific experience with O'Connor and Ginsburg.
We have about 20 minutes left in our hour conversation with you about your book, Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, and talking about the earlier consideration of women to serve on the nation's high court. You tell the stories of nine women who were shortlisted. One of those, Justice O'Connor's nomination, after she was in fact nominated, she faced discrimination, gender discrimination on the court. Some very personal stories about some of the experiences she had. Can you relate some of those?
Absolutely. I mean, it's true for all of the women before they came to the court in their various courts or their various professional roles. And then once they arrive too, you know, in the case of O'Connor, so the mister from the front door of each justice's chambers had been pulled down. Everything had said Mr. Justice, right? So the honorific had been pulled off the doors in part because of an interaction that one of the male justices had with Cornelia Kennedy at a moot court competition, which caused him to reflect on the fact that maybe they should take Mr. off of the front of justice. So that part had been done, but there was not a bathroom facility for her. She was given all of the justices do sort of service assignments. She was given the assignment of dealing with like the Supreme Court cafeteria. So a range of things that might seem subtle, but we find very problematic and concerning. She was not the first judge to face such explicit barriers to the presence of women in professional life. In fact, maybe if we can take a moment, the first woman to show up on a president's shortlist is a woman named Florence Allen. She was the first female justice on the Ohio Supreme Court, which she was elected to after being very active in the suffrage movement. She helped women secure the right to vote, and then she turned around and asked for the vote, and they delivered. They put her on the Ohio Supreme Court. And in 1934, President Roosevelt put her on the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. At that time, again, there was no bathroom facility for her. They had to secure federal funding to build one. The reports of the media coverage of the day, some of her male colleagues fell ill and had to take to bed over the idea of presiding over cases with a woman. So just extreme bias and discrimination and obvious and prevalent. Her male colleagues, Florence Allen's, would dine at an all-male dining club. The entire time she sat on the Sixth Circuit, she never joined her colleagues for a meal. Instead, she used a hot plate in her chambers. And she was shortlisted and considered in particular by Roosevelt in 1937 when he was looking at adding more justices to the Supreme Court. We found a memo in his archives listing her name. And that hot plate, when Florence Allen retired, Cornelia Kennedy, she was nominated and appointed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and Florence Allen gave her that hot plate. But Cornelia Kennedy convinced her male colleagues that it was time to let her join them for lunch or to stop frequenting that establishment. They did, and she was allowed to dine with the male judges, but she kept that hot plate on a marble pedestal in her chambers the entire time she was a judge, just to remind everyone of the very explicit barriers to even the presence of a woman in professional life that so many had to overcome.
That would seem to have a really significance on your ability to do your job, because I'm sure those lunches were more than just camaraderie. They probably discussed cases, which she didn't have the benefit of.
Absolutely. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, we can talk about that happening and maybe we find that outrageous, but it's a dynamic that we in the book write about even still today can exist. And especially we noted a number of studies after the now not so recent, but relatively comparatively recent Me Too movement, where some of the backlash was, well, why, you know, we're just not going to include women at lunches or in these social opportunities. And that can't be the solution, because to your point, that's where a lot of work is done, whether you are a judge and you are deciding cases or you are in professional life generally.
And in Judge Florence Allen's case, you write that she had a very vocal opponent in First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. First ladies come up from time to time in your telling of stories of them trying to convince their husbands. Was there ever any success that you can point to? Because do we know if Nancy Reagan was a proponent, for example, in the case of her husband?
So that's a great question about Nancy Reagan, and I don't know the answer to that, although maybe she didn't have to be as vocal as some of the other first ladies, because he was committing to deliver the first female before he even had the opportunity to do it. In the case of Florence Allen, yes, Eleanor Roosevelt, to be sure, without her advocacy and support for Allen, I don't know that she would have been even appointed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in 1934. And then, interestingly enough, we were talking about Nixon earlier, so Nixon was not taking the idea of a woman on the court seriously, but he was hearing about it from not just his wife, but also his daughters, who wanted to see him appoint the first woman, and discussed that their feelings with him over dinner about their disappointment in his decision not to.
In Harry Truman's presidency, the Chief Justice was Fred Vinson, and you write that he was really the big stumbling block to a woman joining the court. How so?
Yeah, completely appalled. Did not want to have to preside over cases with, you know, shirt collars unbuttoned and shoes off, apparently, as the justices did at the time, because if a woman was present, they wouldn't be able to be so free and relaxed.
A couple more historical stories. We have about 15 minutes left before we come back to current days. The nomination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she passed, there were accolades from all quarters about some of her legacy. But you write in 1992 that both liberal and conservative groups had some reservations. Can you go back in history and tell us about that nomination?
Yeah, I think we forget that she was actually considered quite conservative comparatively. She certainly was not the notorious RBG in any way at all. And there was concern from women's rights groups that she would not be as vocal of a champion as they would want. Now, of course, that's not how it played out, which is not unusual for a Supreme Court justice to, once they are it's a lifetime appointment, one that they are not, I mean, even though the lower federal courts are also lifetime appointments, judges have to be mindful that they can be reversed, or maybe they want to be appointed and elevated in the future. But you get to the Supreme Court and, you know, that's no longer the case. So sometimes justices do change in their philosophies and the way they handle cases. But she's a great example, and one that I think we forget now because we know her so much as not just the incredible justice she was, but this cultural icon, you know, an incredible symbol of progressive radical feminism, the notorious RBG. That was not at all who she was or how she was viewed when Clinton selected her for the Supreme Court.
Did President Clinton seriously consider a second female nomination when he had the chance?
So in terms of serious consideration, it's hard to know. And for Clinton, we don't have access to his archives. So getting into some of the behind the scenes, you know, how people were being vetted and weighed, we rely primarily on autobiographies, interviews that were done by his high level advisors for figuring out his shortlist. But as I said, in the case of Justice Breyer, Amalia Kearse was shortlisted for that seat. Now, how seriously was she considered? Was she was taken seriously enough to be on the shortlist and to be in the mix? But it does seem that until Obama, presidents were content to check the woman box, if you will, by appointing one, but not more than one.
Why did George W. Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers fail? You referenced her earlier, but you write about her in the book.
So is there any one reason? I don't know that I can tell you that, but I can say clearly that looking at her qualifications, she had a background that was not dissimilar to Justice Powell. So she certainly was qualified based on her experience of having been the head of a law firm, having worked for many years as a lawyer in the White House, having been the president of a bar association and the like. But the media's coverage of her was extremely gendered, you know, talking about everything from her bouffant hairstyle as a, you know, high school girl to her size 6 shoes, the car that she drove, her girls' nights out with Condi Rice, the then Secretary of State, and really just feeding into stereotypes of a young girl without experience, which is 100% not what she actually was. She was a well-seasoned lawyer with incredible experience. And so I have to think that part of that had to be why she ultimately, of course, you know, maybe she would have been confirmed. We will never know the answer to that. She withdrew after just over 3 weeks of consideration. And that's we call it in the book a self-shortlisting of sorts, where sometimes highly qualified women aren't willing to put themselves out there. You know, another example of that from the women in the book is Carla Hills, who was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Ford. And he asked her, would you like to be a Supreme Court justice? Do you want to be? And she said no, she didn't want to be on the shortlist. So he kept her on it, but she didn't want to do it, which is perhaps why she was never selected.
When did the tradition of American Bar Association ratings come into play in Supreme Court nominations? And second question, did you see indications of gender bias in the work that they did?
Yes. So the ABA ratings process began most, I guess, significantly, noteworthy in the Eisenhower presidency. He was not a lawyer, and so looking for outside advice to help bring ideas in. And there's a turning point with Reagan. So before Reagan, the ABA would actually be involved in the process before the president announced who the ultimate choice was. So to go back to Nixon's shortlist, the ABA rated Judge Lilly as unqualified, even though on paper years later, Nixon's White House counsel, John Dean, took Lilly's resume and Sandra Day O'Connor's resume and said quite publicly that Lilly was as qualified, if not more qualified than O'Connor. And it was widely known that the ABA system was discriminating against women, minorities, minority women. With Reagan, Reagan did not go through a similar sort of process. And in more recent history, the ABA, first of all, has gone from having a part of its institution that was holding women back to being a much better champion of women. And also in the process now, the ABA's doesn't weigh in until after the nominee is announced. And so there wasn't this behind the scenes vetting of Biden's list in the same way that would have occurred decades ago, perhaps, but the ABA will play a role. And I anticipate deciding that Ketanji Brown Jackson is well qualified when they go to do her rating.
So in anticipating the upcoming confirmation hearings, let's look back to an exchange in 2020 with the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, one particular question that caused quite a bit of conversation.
But Judge, there's a question that comes up in my discussions with my constituents that's really more basic and more personal. They want to know how you do it. How do you and your husband manage two full-time professional careers and at the same time take care of your large family? I'll bet there are many young women, like my own two daughters, who marvel at the balance that you've achieved between your personal and professional life.
As an example of questioning, how does this one stack up?
Well, it's not as bad as another question she got from Senator Kennedy, which is who does the laundry in your house? But, you know, it's not the kind of question that we see for male nominees who also have children. Some have many children. The late Justice Scalia, for whom Justice Barrett clerked, had 9 children, so a very large family. And, you know, not repeatedly grilled over who does the chores or who raises the children. So, you know, on one hand, it reflects the reality that more often than not, although not always, but more often than not, women are the primary caregivers in a household situation involving care needs, whether it's young children, elderly parents. But so it's important to acknowledge this, right? But I don't think that doing so in the context of one Senate confirmation hearing for whether or not an individual is qualified to sit on the Supreme Court is the place to necessarily need to use that amongst how we are vetting who is qualified for the court. And it questions like that suggest that somehow she or another nominee would be not as qualified if they didn't achieve that balance in terms of their caregiving roles. And instead, really, the focus should be, is she able to do the job as a justice? And questions like that certainly take away from it.
What will you be watching for in the confirmation hearings of Judge Jackson?
Well, I will be optimistically hoping that they will focus on her incredible qualifications. And in fact, Judge Jackson, this is not the first time she's been through this process. In fact, she was confirmed by this very Senate about a year ago for the seat that she holds on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Already, though, we are seeing commentary that is highly inappropriate. The piece that I think is being tossed around the most as of late, the question about her LSAT score from Tucker Carlson. I mean, no justice has ever been asked about their LSAT score. The LSAT, it's a law school admissions exam that's mostly word puzzles and reading comprehension. It would be sort of like asking, you know, what's her Wordle statistics look like? And so that kind of questioning, you know, that to me is especially problematic because on the surface, I suppose it suggests that he is actually asking something about her qualification, like what score does she get on an exam? But the fact that no former justice before has ever been subjected to that kind of questioning tells me that it is racist and that it is, you know, a sexist in its origins. So I hope we don't see more questions like that. My hope is that the Senate will focus on her qualifications. And it will be interesting to see whether or not, I mean, she also is a working mother. Will that be something that senators draw out here or not. But to be sure, it's something that she has been willing to talk about publicly. And as I said, it's not that we should, you know, not talk about the realities that the primary caregivers and households face, whether they are men or women. It's that we should talk about them in a context that is appropriate to do so, not when someone is being vetted for their professional position, but in instances, for example, the way Judge Jackson has talked about it, for example, when being invited to speak in a university setting and talk about how she has navigated her own career and her own life.
We have about 4 minutes left. I have two last questions for you. The U.S. Solicitor General is female, and we're facing the imminent possibility of 4 women on the Supreme Court. Does this render the elevation of women to the federal justice system moot?
No, definitely not. And it is wonderful that we have a female SG, Solicitor General, because we now hear more women's voices, hers primarily, at oral argument. But even there, when you look at the number of women who are doing oral argument in front of the Supreme Court, it's dwarfed by the number of men. And we don't have a majority of women on the Supreme Court. We're doing better, but this is certainly not enough. And it's, my hope, only the beginning of a continued effort to make sure that not just the Supreme Court, but our federal judiciary and our justice system, all of the actors in it, better reflect the public that it serves.
So now, if the statistics hold from when I've last looked at them, more than 50% of all law school students are women. If that's the case, then what is the most effective way to widen the pipeline to the federal courts for women?
Well, we can certainly take a page out of President Carter's playbook. So not all of us are going to be able to issue an executive order. But the way that he changed the selection of judges diversified the federal bench in ways that had never before been seen. And President Biden may come close to doing so as well. But having a process in place that both the decision makers are diverse, that it is a diverse candidate pool we are looking at, and importantly, having a commitment to diversity be a part of the qualifications that we are looking for, those are all concrete steps that can be taken, not just in terms of how we select our judges, but anyone who is in a position of vetting someone for a leadership position can apply them to their selection process.
The book is called Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. We just spent an hour with one of the two co-authors, Renee Kanaki Jefferson. Thank you so much for spending time with C-SPAN on this Women's History Month and also in anticipation of Supreme Court nomination hearings. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. And subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.